Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com, and by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
First, he bought up a Chicago manufacturing giant. Now he's insuring municipal bonds. Oh, and buying another insurance company. The Oracle of Omaha has had a busy week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Amy Scott, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, December the 28th. Great to have you with us. That's right, Warren Buffett is at it again. Earlier this week, we told you he'd bought a big stake in manufacturer Marmon Holdings from Chicago's Pritzker family. Now the investing tycoon is launching a bond insurance business. The Berkshire Hathaway Assurance Corporation is expected to open in New York on Monday. The company will act as a safeguard for cities, counties, and states. When they sell bonds to raise money for roads and schools, they often buy insurance. It makes the bonds more attractive to investors. But the bond insurance business isn't exactly buzzing at the moment. Could Buffett's legendary timing be off? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer checks it out.
When Warren Buffett does something, the rest of us usually say, "Why didn't I think of that?" But this time, he's entering tricky territory. Bond issuers buy insurance to get lower interest rates. But interest rates have been quite low over the past 5 years or so, meaning many governments haven't bought bond insurance. So why does Buffett want to sell it now?
I think it's absolutely impeccable timing.
Mark Vittner is senior economist at Wachovia. He says the subprime mess is sending people scurrying back to the safety of bond insurance.
I think that people are paying a lot more attention to the risk and returns on various investments. And so we will probably see an increase in demand for it in coming years, particularly with the economy slowing.
That's good news for the entire bond insurance business. But Buffett has an edge over his competitors. Many of them are tainted because they dabbled in slippery subprime investments. So is this a case of Buffett the bottom feeder?
A bottom feeder is one way to put it, for sure.
Bill Bergman is an equity analyst with Morningstar.
But I think another way to put it is, here's someone who's willing to provide value when very few other people are as willing or as able to do so.
Buffett-backed bonds won't come cheap. Buffett told the Wall Street Journal he'll charge more than his competitors. He doesn't want people to think they can borrow unlimited amounts of money just because he's insuring them. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Buffett didn't stop with bond insurance. There's also word he's buying the reinsurance unit of financial giant ING. The price tag there, about $435 million. Retailers are taking stock after a lackluster holiday shopping season. Macy's said today it will close 9 underperforming stores. You're likely to find some crazy sales as well. And that goes for all kinds of retailers. As Jeremy Hobson reports, it's a short-term fix that could spell long-term trouble.
Retail analyst Patty Edwards says in a typical year, stores lure in consumers after Christmas with sales of up to 50% off. This year, she says, shoppers are seeing discounts of 70% or more.
They are doing anything and everything they can to get the traffic in their doors.
But why do the discounts have to be so big? Robert Pasikoff of the consulting firm Brand Keys Incorporated says it's all about consumer expectations.
The retailers themselves have essentially trained the consumers to understand that a $250 coat is really not worth $250.
So that coat might be on sale for $75 instead. Problem with that, he says, is shoppers won't pay higher prices later now that they're used to the deals. Analysts agree other options to boost profits, like laying off staff, are ineffective in the end because bad service brings down the brand. But not everyone thinks there's a crisis in the industry.
Any discounting that's done right now is done very carefully with sophisticated software so that there's not too much damage to profit margins.
That's retail analyst Richard Hastings.
Yeah, profits won't grow at the same rate, and there will be this slowdown, but it's nothing like these rumors of a total industry meltdown that are circulating out there.
If it's not a meltdown, the industry has definitely sprung a leak. And analysts say retailers are doing whatever they can to patch up the hole in time for the end of most fiscal quarters next month. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The listing ship, that is the U.S. housing market, doesn't show any signs of righting itself yet. Sales of new homes fell another 9% last month to their lowest level in 12 years. Wall Street didn't like that much, but ended the day mixed. We'll have all the details when we do the numbers. Imagine the sheer quantity of toys bought in the last month to be wrapped up and put under the tree for the little ones. Those branded Made in China might have lingered on shelves a little longer than in previous years. Stories of lead paint and other hazards in Chinese-made goods hit the headlines a lot in 2007. So as we cover all the big stories of the year, credit crunch and subprime loans included, how could we not talk about China? Marketplace's Shanghai correspondent Scott Tong joins us to do just that. Hello, Scott.
Amy, hi. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. So, Scott, first it was the pet food, right? And then we started hearing about all sorts of other tainted stuff. Can you remind me how this whole thing started?
Well, you're right. It was the pet food in the spring when the FDA recalled pet food and animal feed. And it turns out that after some investigation that these tainted ingredients came from China. And then as the year went on, as one China businessman put it, the whole thing metastasized as far as a crisis. Toothpaste, tires, and then we heard a lot about Barbie and Batman and lead paint. What you have in a lot of these cases is product substitution, where the suppliers, the people here in China, have cut a corner to cut costs. They have put in a cheaper ingredient or a cheaper additive or a preservative in order to lower their costs. What's happening in China now is there's a huge pressure to cut costs. Labor and raw materials, all that stuff is going up. And so something is going to give, and this is the year when a lot of it gave.
Well, a lot of us are asking, how bad is this? I mean, should we be really avoiding products made in China?
Statistically, you can make a case, this may be hard to believe, that things coming from China are not more dangerous than, say, Mexico or Denmark or the Dominican Republic. What we're confronting here is the scale of China. So if you're in a place where you make 22 billion toys and almost all the vitamin C in the world and on, chances are statistically that when you have a small percentage of things that don't go right, they'll probably come from China.
Well, one of the things that surprised me was hearing about the deliberate cases of cutting corners. But some other people were at fault here, right?
The fault conversation is a long one. You have, of course, the suppliers who are accused and in some cases have been found of cutting corners. You also have all the levels of the people who are supposed to be checking the process, right? You have the regulators in China. You have the Western buyers. And in a lot of cases, people in China say they've looked the other way. And then you have the American regulators who are supposed to be checking and are accused of also being kind of lax at the border, checking the quality of things coming into the States. Now, the good news is all of the above have been sufficiently embarrassed now that they're starting to put the fixes in place. Companies are being shut down in China. Export licenses are being revoked. And the companies that are buying the things from China are monitoring them more than ever. If your resume, Amy, says supply chain management on it, now's probably the time to come to China.
Well, how has this whole scandal affected a trade for China? I mean, is it going to really slow down this Chinese miracle we've been watching?
We don't see a slowdown yet. For instance, the statistics as far as orders for toys coming from southern China, those numbers aren't going down yet. But there are a lot of questions in the longer term that are being asked now. One of the biggest questions is the issue of the Made in China image. If you'll remember, when you and I were really small, stuff from Japan had kind of this tin can image.
Right.
And China's really trying to fight that because China's really trying to move up the value chain, to be kind of an economic grown-up and not make all low-cost, low-margin kinds of things, to make more disk drives and precision auto parts. And if the Made in China image is really tainted, that's really going to slow that down.
All right. Our man in Shanghai, Scott Tong, thanks so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Amy. Thanks a lot.
Real estate developers and the newly rich are eyeing some of Ireland's most beautiful rural towns. Local authorities, on the other hand, would like them to take their mansion-building money elsewhere. Some towns have created strict tests for who's allowed to build, like where you were born or whether you speak Gaelic. From the west coast of Ireland, Stephen Beard catches up with the locals and their laws.
Well, we're here in Connemara, West County Galway. Out there you have Galway Bay. Further west there, you can see the Aran Islands.
Joseph O'Cuig, a local councillor and journalist, shows off the Connemara countryside where he lives and works.
One of the most beautiful places in Ireland, certainly, and in Europe probably, and in the world even.
But, he says, the beauty has attracted real estate developers and city dwellers looking to build sprawling luxury villas along the coast are threatening to squeeze out the locals.
Well, when you have a lot of money sloshing around, people with money move in, buy houses, they push up the prices. After a while, you will notice that local people cannot compete at all.
Here in Galway County Hall, they've adopted a locals-only planning rule. In certain rural areas, people have to prove a strong local connection before they get a building permit. In some cases, they've got to speak Gaelic too. Paud O'Neacton has the job of testing the Gaelic language skills of would-be house builders. They have to be fluent. At first, not everyone took the test seriously.
Some estate agents felt it was a case of speak to your local parish priest and he'll send you in with a few words and you'll be fine.
In fact, half the applicants fail the test. There are locals-only laws cropping up all over Ireland, but a backlash is underway. This man, who prefers to remain anonymous for fear of upsetting the local planners, says he was denied a rural building permit in spite of strong family connections to the area.
Well, in a local cemetery, I have my parents, my mother's parents, my grandfather's parents. I have four uncles, three aunts, two cousins, all buried in a local cemetery. I spent my childhood in a local farm, which was my mother's home place.
But you're not sufficiently local for the planning authorities?
No one is ever sufficiently local for them.
The Irish Rural Dwellers Association is campaigning against the rule. The association's head, Jim Connolly, says Ireland is the most thinly populated country in Europe. Rural communities here need new residents and the money they bring.
If you have a sparsely populated rural community, which is being denied an influx of new blood and new people, they will become inbred. They cannot survive without people.
At the Gaelic language radio station where he works, Councillor O'Cuig insists that the locals-only rule is needed to help the Irish language and rural communities survive.
This is the fundamental question all over the world. Do you put your complete faith in the market, or do you say, yes, the market with certain restrictions?
The Irish Supreme Court will soon decide whether the locals-only rule is unconstitutional, infringing every Irish citizen's right to own property, regardless of who they are or where they were born. In Galway, on the west coast of Ireland, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Time now to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas. Hey, David.
Hey, Amy. Oh, it's good to hear from you. Nice to hear a friendly voice. And Amy, I'm sorry, but I can only do about an 80% job today.
Why is that?
Well, in fact, I don't even know if I can do 80%, come to think of it. Well, we were closed one day, you may have heard.
I heard.
And
I
then
was
we
here.
Came back, and volume was like half what it normally is. And it just wasn't, I mean, it wasn't a normal week at all.
Did you ever get that Santa Claus rally everyone was talking about?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, a little bit of the Santa Claus rally. And then they would come along and just scare the bejeebers out of us. Just when you think you can't hear any more bad news about financials, good old Goldman Sachs comes along and says, you know, the three big financial giants are going to lose, oh, we think like double what they think, $33.5 billion.
And it was then, a good week and, to announce that.
Well, and then did you see the housing numbers, the latest housing
numbers?
Oh, yeah. Goodness. And then there was the thing that Wall Street handles so poorly, and that is, that was this situation yesterday where right before the opening you had the assassination, you know, of a major world leader. And you said, well, is that, let's see, what does that mean? Does that mean higher oil prices or saber rattling or unrest? Oh, well, what the heck, we'll just sell off just in case.
You think that's what it was?
I think so. I mean, I don't think it was a very learned sell-off that we had yesterday. And in fact, everybody sort of breathed a sigh of relief because we woke up and we looked at the Indian market, which I guess, you know, you would think would be maybe the most affected by Pakistan. And it was unchanged. So we said, oh, well, we'll go find something else to worry with. And so we went back to the housing and the financials and the stuff like that. But you know, the truth is it really has been really the last week has been very busy for us. While all of our friends have been out watching football games and playing and standing in line to return things they got that they don't want, we've been going through accounts and looking for losses.
Well, it seems like there are a lot of places to find those losses this year. Can you walk me back through some of the losers this year?
Financial stocks just hammered. Housing stocks just hammered. And the antithesis, the other side, are just the internationals. Anybody with international exposure. In fact, the Dow Jones Industrials average this year is outperforming the Standard & Poor's 500, which truthfully happens about half the time. But, I mean, it's almost twice as good. And that's really because so many of those stocks in the Dow Jones Industrials average, the Intels and the McDonald's and Caterpillar Tractors all have international exposure, and they're doing well. So with hindsight, that's all we should have bought, and we shouldn't have bought the stuff that went down. I've learned my lesson. I'm never going to buy a stock that goes down again.
Well, we can't go out on this note, David. What do you have planned for New Year's?
I have a very quiet New Year's because I got to work a full day the day before, and then we got to come back on Wednesday. So maybe a little football and early to bed.
It's hard being a stockbroker down in Dallas. Thanks, David Johnson.
Happy New Year, Amy.
Happy New Year to you. Coming up, tabletop games went to the web. Now the sides may be switching.
We decided to kind of turn that around and say, what can we take from electronic gaming that we see that is an improvement on traditional pencil and paper role-playing games?
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks were basically flat today on Wall Street after the Commerce Department reported that sharp decline in new home sales. The Dow nudged up less than 0.1%, or 6 points, to close at 13,365. The Nasdaq inched lower by less than 0.1%, or 2 points, to close at 2674. The S&P 500 nosed up 0.1%, or 2 points, to end the day at 1478. For the week, the Dow finished down 0.6%. The Nasdaq fell 0.7%, and the S&P 500 lost 0.4%. Those poor home sales numbers hammered builders. KB Home and D.R. Horton toppled more than 4% apiece. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.08. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for November. On December 31st, 1973, AC/DC played their first gig at a club in Sydney, and it's the last day to make good on your 2007 resolutions or look ahead to the new year. Take your pick from some of About.com's top 10. Spend more time with family, get fit, lose weight, quit smoking, quit drinking, get out of debt, or learn something new. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. If Japan's Sanrio company has its way, the men in your life will be much easier to shop for next holiday season. The maker of Hello Kitty said today it's rolling out a line of stuff aimed at guys in their teens and early 20s, first in Japan, then here in the U.S. Commentator Ben Kaznoka is just the kind of customer they're after, but don't expect him to line up for a Hello Kitty man purse anytime soon.
If you listen to the hyperventilation of marketers, you'll hear a lot about how elusive youngins born between 1985 and 1995 are, and how this generation, Gen Y, will require marketers to rethink their entire playbook. The consultancy Talent Smoothie, for example, promises unique Gen Y research and insight on their website. By asserting how different we millennials are, they tell marketers that understanding us is an undertaking which, guess what, demands their consulting services. Yes, Gen Y is different. We grew up online. We won't get drafted for a war. But our most profound characteristic might be our weak collective consciousness. Our individual identity is stronger and more authentic than our social one. From the Depression through Vietnam, people the same age grew up around shared experiences. And from these common experiences, definable generations were born. People consume the culture and products directed at their age group. Their social network consisted of whoever lived on their cul-de-sac. And if they needed world news, Walter Cronkite told them. Thanks to the internet and globalization, we uber-connected hipsters aren't constrained by incidental factors the way our parents were. Sure, we might share a faint generational dialect with people our own age, but we're finding that a common obsession is a better predictor for a meaningful bond between two people, a lot better than the year our parents happened to have unprotected sex. You can develop obscure passions by joining virtual, ageless communities around your interests. Love Scottish lighthouses? I guarantee that there's a community for you. Want to start a business selling indie music on MySpace? Nothing stopping you. All this means that it's harder than ever to generalize about generational behavior. There's no magic millennial dust, Facebook, blogs, emo, that you can sprinkle on your marketing to make it appeal to today's youth. If you want to sell us something, you're going to have to find us, and then not treat us like aliens who parachuted to Earth from the planet Krypton.
Ben Kaznoka wrote the book My Startup Life, What a Very Young CEO Learned on His Journey Through Silicon Valley. He's a college freshman. Are you feeling at home in your demographic? Let us know. We're at marketplace.org. Shares in Atari Inc. hit record lows today. The plunge followed warnings that NASDAQ might delist the company due to its falling stock price. Atari's had a lot of competition since it hit the scene in 1972 with the video game Pong. But it isn't the only victim of the rise of fancy game consoles like Nintendo's Wii. David Chong takes a look at one retro game trying to reinvent itself for the digital age.
And?
Attack.
And draw a bow and hit the ogre, I guess.
Listeners in tune with their inner geek probably recognize the sounds of Dungeons & Dragons, the iconic pen and paper role-playing game. Players pretend to be fantasy characters like wizards and elves for epic adventures similar to The Lord of the Rings.
You shall not pass!
This game group in Santa Monica, California gets together every Saturday night. Led by their dungeon master, they come armed with their imaginations and, of course, the D20, the 20-sided die. But the casting of dice and spells could soon be moving from the kitchen table to the internet, where battling monsters tend to sound a little different.
Fall back!
That's actually from the online game World of Warcraft. Players also fight ogres and orcs in a fantasy universe, but Warcraft players only meet online and follow a preset plot, instead of a dungeon master's imagination. The classic Dungeons & Dragons board game served as a model for many of these online games, and they've become a multi-billion dollar industry.
So we decided to kind of turn that around and say, what can we take from electronic gaming that we see that is an improvement on traditional pencil and paper role-playing games?
That's Liz Hsu. She's in charge of marketing Dungeons & Dragons. She doesn't want to sacrifice the intimacy of having players get together to roll some dice, but she says it's time to add some online features. One is an online game board where players will no longer have to meet face-to-face.
We expect a lot of people to play D&D around their kitchen table just like they have always done, but we've also added the option for people who may live in remote corners of the world to log in and play virtually around what we're kind of calling the virtual kitchen table.
College student Jeremy Luth understands how tough it is to keep a gaming group together. His high school gaming group went to different colleges and only gets to meet once a year.
So if there's something that gives us online access and something that makes it easier for us to communicate from long distances, we may be able to get together and play a game.
A voice feature lets players talk over the internet, and a dungeon master still facilitates the action. But what will traditional tabletop players think about rolling a virtual 20-sided die? Longtime player Arthur Turney is dungeon master for the Santa Monica group.
That's not the be-all and the end-all of the game. The dice merely gives you a chance to see how the story is supposed to go. And it doesn't matter if you roll the dice or if the computer rolls the dice for you.
Dungeons & Dragons producers say they aren't interested in a piece of the online role-playing game business. The idea is to get people hooked on Dungeons & Dragons so they keep buying the figurines and other accessories. Player Jeremy Leith says if the game gets more popular, maybe non-players will see it as a little less geeky.
I think there's definitely sort of a stigma behind D&D for a lot of people and for role-playing games in general. If some of that went away, that'd be better.
In Los Angeles, this is David Chong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto was laid to rest today as violence tore through the country. A mob looted banks in the financial capital of Karachi. Elsewhere, demonstrators torched cars and foreign fast food outlets. Bhutto was killed yesterday, but her words will linger long after her death. HarperCollins is rushing into print a manuscript it received from Bhutto recently. The book, Reconciliation, Islam, Democracy, and the West, is expected to reach bookstores soon, possibly by February. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 6 points, less than 0.1%. The Nasdaq drooped 2 points, less than 0.1%. And the S&P 500 rose 2 points, 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yore. Next time on the program, executive education in China struggles for a higher grade.
Teachers do not necessarily push or challenge students to explore ideas, to probe deeper, to ask why.
I'm Amy Scott. Hope you have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.